all across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Good day. I'm Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today here on Veterans Radio, and thanks for joining us. We've got some interesting stories for you. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or at the web, veteransradio.org, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to veteransradio.org. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. And finally, PuroClean. PuroClean is the paramedics of property damage. It provides water damage remediation, flood water removal, fire and smoke damage remediation, mold removal, biohazard cleanup. It also has a focus on veteran franchisees. You can learn more about them by going to puroclean.com. Today's broadcast is going to hear from a couple of Medal of Honor recipients. And as a host, I'm Jim Fossone, as mentioned. I think Dale and I always find this an incredible honor that Veterans Radio has had the opportunity to talk to so many Medal of Honor recipients. There aren't that many alive these days. I think it's about 60 at the moment. But these men are humble in recognizing that on a given day, they kind of went above and beyond in the area of valor and courage. We're going to talk to Clint Romeshaw and Earl Plumley. Both have different stories, but it's really interesting to hear these men. And at the end of the program, we're going to talk a little bit about the National Medal of Honor Museum, which just opened up in Arlington, Texas. It's April, but just last a couple of weeks ago, a month ago, in March was Medal of Honor Day. So kind of in honor of all of that stuff going on, we thought we'd bring you these two stories from Medal of Honor recipients. We want to welcome today, and it's a special privilege to have Medal of Honor recipient Clint Romeshaw on the line with us. Clint, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me today.
Well, this is a real honor for us. We try to tell veteran stories and have been fortunate over the 20 years we've been doing this to talk to a lot of Medal of Honor recipients. And so we're going to talk with Clint today about himself, a little bit about the battle where his heroics got recognized, but more about kind of what it means, what's involved with being a Medal of Honor recipient. Clint received his Medal of Honor for his actions during the Battle of Kamdesh in 2009 during the war in Afghanistan at a place called Combat Outpost Keating. We'll get into a little bit more of that, but Clint, let's start with how did a nice guy like you end up in the U.S. Army?
So for me, I mean, you could partially say it was kind of a family business with my grandfather, being an Army guy, combat engineer, World War II. My dad was a Vietnam infantryman, did a couple of tours in Vietnam. Both my older brothers had served, so when it kind of came time to graduation, you know, part of me wants to say I did it because of the family tradition, and that was part of it. But part of it, too, was it was, you know, 1999. There wasn't a lot going on in the world, and I just wanted to go out and kind of see the world. I wanted to, you know, kind of give back to the country, do my time. I think maybe I was thinking I'll do 4 years, I'll get some college money, and we'll go from there, which has always kind of impressed me with the great men and women that served after September 11th. Because like I said, when I joined, we were at peace. And all those kids that, like I said, put that uniform on afterwards, like they knew what they were getting into. And they willingly made that volunteer choice to go do that.
Well, you graduated high school in California, and I have a note here that loved playing ice hockey. I mean, you kind of had the regular upbringing of an American kid, it sounds like, right?
Yeah, we grew up, like I said, in a tiny little town in Northern California. We're ranchers and farmers. That's what he did going to school. Before going to school every day was they had three cows to milk, and that was just we raised alfalfa, and that was just kind of that. The great thing about being in the military, my first exposure was meeting guys from like New York City and the big cities of from around our country. And that's what I always kind of talk to the kids about is that the different. There's so many different walks of life that you get exposed to in the military, and this is a great and big country. You kind of, as you're growing up, you think you're on that little island, and that's the only thing there is out there. But to get that exposure to it is one of those just processes of life that I think everybody should be kind of privy to.
Well, I think at times, Clint, people think those of you who's received the Medal of Honor for the heroics under such combat situations must have grown up in with a Superman's cape on, and you were just a superhero waiting for your time to come. But as I say, you were just sort of a regular guy. You don't you ne certainly never viewed yourself in that light, I suspect.
No, I wasn't like I grew up being the captain of a football team. Shoot, when I graduated high school, I mean, I was all of 5'5" and about 110 pounds. And like I said, I can dig fence line and I can milk cows, and that's the background I came from. It wasn't said anything super spectacular.
So you did 12 years in the Army, came out as a staff sergeant. Let's talk about a few of your deployments before the final deployment, if you will, in Afghanistan. Tell us a little bit about Kosovo and Iraq a couple of times and military life, because along the way you get married and all of those other things happen as well. So set this up for us about where you were experienced and mentally prepared for that final campaign in Afghanistan.
It goes back to, yeah, if it didn't have if it wasn't for all the other things I'd went through prior to the Afghanistan deployment, I mean, we can always play the who knows or what ifs, but I do think, like I said, my first deployment was Kosovo back in 99. Like I said, when I graduated high school, went to my dad, told him I was wanting to join the Army. I was 17 at the time, and he told me no, because he's like, no, I'm not going to sign for you.
He wasn't smart enough to say go to the Air Force.
Well, the first thing he said was, if you're going to join the military, go get a job that's not combat arms. Get something that you can do after you take the uniform off, because there's not a lot of opportunities for combat arms guys with direct skill transfers and stuff. And so,
And
like I said,
once
that was
again, you didn't listen to Dad, did you?
I don't think many of us kids really understand what our parents are truly trying to tell us until we strike out on our own and kind of I've always loved the discipline of failure. Nothing motivates you more than
There you go.
failing at something to teach you a good lesson. But back then he told me, I'm not going to sign for you because maybe not tomorrow and maybe not in 20 years. But if you put the uniform on, you might have to go and do and see things that you shouldn't have to go do and see. Like I said, Dad and Grandpa never shared their kind of combat experiences when they were in. They were. All the stories they shared was always about their buddies and the camaraderie and the shenanigans they'd get into, but they always kept very tight-lipped and never would open up about their times in combat. So as a young, a young kid, especially growing up in the 80s and 90s, you got this idea of what war is and the exposure of Desert Storm, Desert Shield, that was in and out, relatively quickly, and our technology really kind of triumphed. So when I first got on my deployment, going to Kosovo, that's where it first kind of sparked what my dad was talking about, going and doing and see things that no one should have to go do and see. At that time in Kosovo, with the mass genocide going back and forth between the Serbs and the Albanians and Milosevic and all that kind of chaos going on over there, it really put in perspective for me, excuse me, like what I took for granted growing up in this country. I used to complain growing up in that tiny town in Northern California, like the nearest McDonald's was over an hour away.
Oh my God, how could you live, right?
I know how tragic, how just my man, my life was so rough and tough, and all of a sudden I'm 18 years old and I'm in a foreign country where we literally are escorting either Albanians through Serbian towns or Serbians through Albanian towns to go get fuel for their tractors so they can farm, so they can provide enough food just to survive a winter. Because if they didn't have a military escort, they'd typically get attacked and killed trying to go, from one town to the next that wasn't either, Albanian or Serbian. And like, so that I just put into perspective right away. It's like, man, what kind of a punk kid have I been complaining about? McDonald's is over an hour away growing up. And there's literally people living on this earth that if you don't have a military escort, you can't even go get fuel for your tractor to plow your field to keep your family alive for a winter. So that's, and a lot of that was peacekeeping operations back then too. So it wasn't direct, combat for us. But like I said, without kind of that realization of, I think we forget because we do live pretty comfortable in America. So it's very easy to forget how much evilness and nastiness and just suffering is going on around the world.
Well, that had to replay itself when you went to a couple of deployments to Iraq. Tell us about that.
So the two deployments to Iraq, my first one was at kind of 2004, 2005 time frame. So very much still very kinetic over there, just after kind of the initial shock and awe and this initial kickoff in 2003. Things had, obviously settled down some by then, but we weren't direct fighting at that time. Saddam's army, they'd been pretty much disbanded, but there was still very much hot and heavy. And I was one of the lucky souls that I came out of Second ID out of Korea. They actually put together a brigade and deployed us from Korea to Iraq on the first deployment that I went on. Like I said, that really was, in my mind, it was like I was actually getting ready to get out of the army at that point. I had a guaranteed return assignment coming back to Fort Irwin, and I volunteered to go with the unit. And my colonel, because I was a gunner on his tank at the time, he kind of told me, he's like, Clint, you got a guaranteed return assignment. Fort Irwin's TRADOC, you can go back there and get out of the army in 2 years and you never have to see a day in combat. But for me, it was like, well, that's what I signed up to do. I felt like I was kind of not checking all the blocks of military service, that we had a war going on, and how could I do, how could I serve and not actually go when I had buddies that I'd lost at that point from my previous units, and then guys that I knew through basic training that were injured, and it felt selfish not to volunteer to want to go. And so that first deployment was still very kinetic, trying to take the fight to the enemy. But yet it opened my eyes too, like you think you have an idea of what combat is. You have this kind of fantasy that it's, oh, it's always heroic and just glorious and everything's, just over the top and good will always triumph. And as long as you're, the best and the best, no one will ever get hurt. And the reality of war and combat on that first one very quickly sunk in. It's like, nope, everybody's vulnerable. You can have the best, this, that, and the other, but sometimes it's not your day, and the enemy is gonna, they're gonna be thinking, and they're trying to do bad things to us. So we got to be on our toes. And that's when I got into very quickly, kind of got into the mindset that, you want to take, you're gonna take your guys over, and the reality is you can't bring them all home.
But obviously that's what you're working at the goal line, and you did a number of training programs. Again, this is all background to sort of set up the activities of that day the outpost. But you had training in long-range reconnaissance courses, advanced leader course, air assault training, cavalry scout, all of that building the blocks of the soldier that you were becoming and were going to need to be on that day. Did it feel like you were adding building blocks?
Every step of the way. I said from the first Iraq to the second Iraq deployment, those were two totally different deployments in the way you had to have your mindset and the way your tactics worked. Like I said, the first one was still very kinetic. We were really going after the bad guys directly. And then come the time of the second one, of course, that's the 2006 to 2008, and that's more the surge, and that's more hearts and mind and more rebuilding. So then you got to kind of shift gears that, yeah, you still got bad guys wanting to take you out, but it's also about, let's get these guys back on their feet so they can take care of their own country, so we don't have to be here for, you know, forever and eternity. And so it gives you kind of the perspective of when you need to kind of come down on the sledgehammer, and then the perspective of sheathing your saber and having some restraint to understand that you got to build things back up after you kind of tear them down and rip them apart. And every time in between, all the training between those deployments all just are like little Lego pieces that you continue to add on to make, you know, something more than just scattered chaos.
As I say, all of this builds to who you were on that day in October of 2009 at Outpost Keating in eastern Afghanistan. To set this up a little bit, Combat Outpost Keating may have been the worst location in the entire Afghan theater for a base or an outpost. It was down in a valley. All the high ground looking down on it was just rife with being positioned so that the Taliban could lob rockets, grenades, shots, what have you in. And on that particular day, a force of 300 Taliban insurgents attacked the base, which maybe had 50 guys in it. And quickly they infiltrated. And surprisingly, this 12-hour battle is filmed, a lot of it's filmed by the Taliban. So if you're interested in more of sort of what's going on and seeing some of that activity, it's really replayed in a couple of places for our veteran radio listeners. And we're talking to Clint Romeshaw, who received the Medal of Honor for his activities on that day at Camp Outpost Keating. There's a movie, The Outpost. He wrote a book, The Red Platoon. There are on YouTube really interesting interviews with Clint. There's a CBS Sunday Morning from interview from about 8 years ago. So you can get a lot more about the actual battle itself. And actually, you'll see the changing beard of Clint Clint, are you clean-shaven today, or you have that great beard going?
I don't have the big beard going, but again, like I said, living up in North Dakota, I grow those things for survival come wintertime. They're not really a fashion statement.
But all joking aside, the U.S. Army ultimately closed Outpost Keating, considering it indefensible, which was, you know, it was of no value to those of you who had to fight that day and got injured that day. Why don't you give us just a brief, this is what I want people to know that happened in that battle on that day.
You know, the big things I always want people to know is it wasn't just me out there. Like I said, I had 50 other guys, two Latvians, fighting right there to my left and right. And eight of those great men gave up their life that day. And if it wasn't for their sacrifice, one for the 50 other guys there, wasn't for us working together, like we wouldn't have came out. We would not have came out of that valley. It goes back to that teamwork, that brotherhood, that camaraderie, and the fight that day wasn't about politics. It wasn't about whether we should be in Afghanistan or not. It was literally about the love of your fellow warrior to your left and right, knowing that they had your back and would do everything to include lay down their life to protect you, and you wanted to do the same for them. And the enemy that we fought that day was very proficient. They knew exactly what they were doing. They were veteraned, they were seasoned, They wanted to come in and kill us because they hated everything we stood for. And we came out on top that day because of the great values that this country has instilled, I think, in every red-blooded American, of that loyalty, love, patriotism, duty, honor, respect, selfless service, courage, sacrifice. And it was because of all of those things that love and selfless sacrifice and courage trumped the hatred that we faced in the Taliban fighters that day.
I want to highlight one example of those qualities that you've just mentioned, and that is, as I said earlier, this is a 12-hour battle. You guys are running out of ammunition, food, water, everything, and you get to the point where the ammo depot's some number of yards away, 100 yards away, sort of thing, and you have to ask for volunteers to go with you and try to retrieve, get to that building, get some ammo distributed. Is there anybody who's going to go with me? And the guys stand up. That's really got to be one of those spine-chilling moments in your life.
I've got a couple of very fond and just proud moments looking back on my life, and that hands down is one of them. To sit there and, essentially, during the course of everything that has gone on, I'm sitting there and I go into the barracks and I'm asking for a group of volunteers. And like I said, I had five guys that stood up. It was Raz, Delaney, Danley, and Jonesy, and Miller. And then I told them what I was wanting them to volunteer for. And essentially, it was potentially a suicide mission. We are going to attack the enemy that's got the high ground, that's got us outgunned, outnumbered. They've got the initiative. Everything is stacked against us. And I like I said, I just said it's I just need volunteers, and you don't have to come if you don't want to. And each and every one of them just kind of looked at me and said, would follow you anywhere. And I on a leader, on a personal note, to have another human being literally tell you, not just tell you, but go out and actually then go do it by their actions, that I will follow you anywhere. It was a moment that is just always going to be forever in my heart. The other spectacular thing that I got to be part of is that was month three into a 12-month deployment. And I got to watch for another 9 months those men from Red Platoon pull up their big boy pants and continue the mission for 9 more months in country. Not a single one of the guys from Red Platoon said, that day was too tough on me, too much had happened. They didn't kind of play the woe is me and the pity party. Each one of those young men continued mission, and we didn't kind of take a knee and reflect truly on that day until we got back to the States 9 months after that. And that's another moment that is super proud of the leader, that you can get those guys, after going through all of that, to have the resiliency, the discipline, and the strength to sit there and say, you know what, we're going to finish this mission out, and we're going to finish it outright.
Now, this battle resulted in nine soldiers, no, eight American soldiers who were killed, and nine soldiers were decorated with the Silver Star Medal. And on another part of the camp, in a whole different area that Clint had no idea what was going on over there, another Army Staff Sergeant, Ty Carter, was undergoing his own set of heroics, which resulted in the award of the Medal of Honor. But in your instance, Clint, who advanced the package for you to receive the Medal of Honor? I think the general public kind of doesn't understand how this comes about.
I'm still not 100% clear on that myself, because I said I'd gotten back from that deployment. I used that was going to be, like I said, my last enlistment in the Army. I figured at that point I'd been in about 10 years, or it was going on 10 years right before that deployment. And I thought to myself, well, this will be my last kind of hoorah, and I'll do this last one, and I'll get out and figure out what I'm going to grow up to be in life. So my last year in the Army, I did my transitioning stuff just like every other soldier, tried to work on my resume, tried my networking. And I stepped out the door on terminal leave, and January 2011, going up to North Dakota to chase oil fields. And I worked up there for 2 years. And in that 2 years, I'd call and talk to some of my old troopers and stuff that were still in, and we'd have those conversations every so often, like, hey, Sir Roe, did you ever get anything for that day on October 3rd? And I'd be like, I don't know, Mike, Stoney Porter said something the day after or so about putting me in for a DSC, but I haven't heard a peep about it. And Raz, you got your Silver Star. Well, yeah. It's like, well, that's you got your stuff. I made sure all the guys were taken care of before I took the uniform off, and that's what I'd kind of just gravitate back to. So it wasn't until I said 2 years later, I'm sitting there in the oil field, and I get this call on my phone from a number I didn't recognize. But I went ahead and answered it, and on the other end of the line, all of a sudden, it's, "Hey, this is Colonel Davis, G1 from the Pentagon." And immediately, first thought is like, "Oh crap!
What did
Like,
I
the
do?
statute of limitations should be up for anything, And it's very rare that you'll ever have a full bird colonel, typically reaching directly out to a a staff sergeant, let alone a former staff sergeant that had been out for 2 years. And he just very quickly had me kind of identify myself and say, "Hey, we need you to come out to DC. We got something to tell you." I'm sitting there trying to talk to him on the phone. It's like, that's the great thing about cell phones, sir, is you can just tell me over the phone. I don't have to go anywhere. I'm working 6 to 7 days a week out in the oil fields here, and I don't know if I'll get time off, so just tell me. And he's like, "No, it's something we got to do in person." I was able to talk to my boss and finally got a free weekend, and I went out there. And it wasn't until I got to DC, went to the Pentagon for the first time. They sat me down, they started giving me the brief, and as I looked down, there's three posters in front of me, and one's of Sal Giunta, the first living recipient since Vietnam to receive the medal. The next one is Sergeant Leroy Petrie, Army Ranger, living recipient, and the third one was a Sergeant Sabo, medal, Vietnam posthumous, and it's Medal of Honor, Medal of Honor, Medal of Honor. And I just kind of remember looking down at that, kind of zoning out, just being bewildered, because, like I said, in the back of my mind when I initially got the call, said I remembered Stoney Portis told me he was going to put me in for a DSC, but really what I was thinking when I went out there is they probably downgraded it to maybe a Silver Star, and it would just be a handshake and maybe take a picture or something, and I'd jump back on the plane and fly back to North Dakota after I've done my time there and just get back to where I left off. But then all of a sudden I'm staring at Medal of Honor, Medal of Honor, Medal of Honor, and I just kind of remember looking up and calling a timeout and asking the all the brass in there, it's like, what the heck is this? Like, I got told I got put in for a DSC. Why is this Medal of Honor stuff in front of me? And they go, "Well, you've been recommended for upgrade. Short of the president signing your award, you'll be receiving the Medal of Honor." Like I said, I had no indication prior to that moment that there was a recommendation for upgrade. That, I mean, I didn't even, like I said, know the status of what happened with the DSC after I'd talked to Stoney Portis just a couple of days after the battle. Like I said, that was kind of the farthest thing in my mind. So it was immediately just shocking to hear that what I got credit for that day. I just thought to myself, well, that was just doing my job, and I didn't do it alone, and I had other guys there to my left and right, and I had those eight men that gave up their life and aren't here. Like, it should have been any one of those guys. Why me?
Yeah, I think I've every Medal of Honor recipient I've spoken to has sort of said the same thing. I was just doing my job. There were a lot more guys who were a lot braver than I was on that day. But that's how you feel, obviously. The review boards, the brass all the way on up, saw this as something different. And it's not just for you, right? It's really a recognition that the country wants the whole community, or all the communities which you're a part of, to be recognized in. And there are a lot of communities that look at this and say, hey, that's my guy, whether he was from a little town in Northern California or up in the oil fields of Minot, North Dakota area. It's sort of a recognition for a whole lot of people, isn't it?
Yes, that's So it's something that, like I said, in that moment, I couldn't even begin to wrap my head around. But now, time has gone by, and I got to meet some of the first Medal of Honor recipient I ever got to meet was Major General Foley. And before that, I never thought in a million years I'd ever meet a Medal of Honor recipient, let alone be acknowledged for the award. And then all of a sudden, I'm meeting a retired three-star general that was awarded his back in Vietnam. And that's one of those incredible things is I still remember the first piece of advice General Foley gave me, and he's like, "You got to learn how to say no." Because after receiving the medal, he's like, "You'll be asked to go and do a whole bunch of things, and they're really great, but he's like, you always got to make sure you're true to yourself and take time for your family.
Absolutely.
You are going to have to learn how to say no to certain things."
Well, we are certainly glad you didn't say no to Veterans Radio, Clint Romeshaw, today. Let me ask you to tell us a little bit about what's it like being in the White House on the day you're to receive the award. I know they put you in the back room before they all bring you out. I mean, the real world doesn't get a chance to look inside that or get a feel for that. Tell us about that day.
That day was just a whirlwind of emotions. And I mean, I can only imagine it's like a bride at her wedding day, but on steroids, right? So I remember getting to the White House, and they brought me and my family in early. They gave us like a private tour and kind of gave us kind of the lay of the land on how the ceremony and stuff should be. And as we're doing that, the rest of everybody else is kind of going through the security, and they're going into the room the ceremony is going to be in. And then it came time to go, like I said, go into the Oval Office and meet President Obama. I just remember prior to that, it's been about a decade ago. So like my youngest, he's 13 now, but at that time, I think he was 1.5. My middle daughter was, I think, 3. So of course, back of our mind is like,
right,
not really the place you bring a 3 and a 1.5 year old. But the White House and Michelle, First Lady, and the president were just like, "No, bring the kids. We want the kids." So what I remember is being in the Oval Office, sitting there kind of talking to President Obama, and he's talking to my parents and stuff. And I'm looking over, and I got one kid running on the furniture and the other kid grabbing apples out of their little basket on the coffee table and just taking one bite and not liking it and throwing it back. And I'm just sitting there kind of shaking my head thinking, man, the president and first lady think I'm probably one of the worst dads ever, that I got these unruly 3 and 1.5 year old kids just acting a fool here in the Oval Office. But they were very warm and welcoming and absolutely loved it that we brought the kids with. And like I said, my oldest daughter, who's now 23, she was only 12 at the time herself. But we got done. President Obama signed my award. And then we were walking from the Oval Office to the ceremony room, kind of crossing through the lawn. And I just remember sitting there just kind of having a quiet conversation with President Obama, like, this is really weird for me. I appreciate the hospitality. And unbeknownst to me at the time, me and the president, we split to go into the final briefing room. And the rest of our family, the rest of my family, went into the ceremony room. Didn't realize it at the time. Wasn't until after the fact that my 1.5 year old son, prior to us walking through the door, as we'd had that tour earlier, he had known there was a glass of water set behind the podium where the president was going to give a speech. So right before we came in, apparently he broke free. He was running up on stage. One of the Marines was trying to chase him down to get him out of the way of the podium, knowing me and the president were about to walk in.
and there's this great picture of it.
Yes.
There's this picture of this little dude looking at the podium. He's got his suit coat on. He's looking sharp. But that's not told in many of the stories. I've seen the picture. I didn't get, I wonder how that happened. So they finally corralled him and got him back in a seat.
Yes, they corralled him, got him back in the seat. And the chaplain even told my family and stuff, "Hey, look, if Colin's my youngest, hey, he's 1.5 year old. If he's going to get up and just let him do it." Like, so we'd kind of had permission from the chief of chaplains. But like I said, we didn't, me and the president didn't know that. So when the president's kind of giving his speech, he's talking about my son then in the Oval Office grabbing those apples. So then everybody kind of had a good chuckle because they got to see firsthand of kind of his personality.
We know what he's up to. Did a number of your Red Platoon guys get to attend the ceremony?
Yes, I think we ended up having, it was almost 20, what was it, 22 of them that had gotten out, that were there to attend. And then I think we had another 12 or 15 that were still active, so they were able to come in on the Army side wearing their uniform. That's going back to that day. Like I said, it was just a whirlwind. There's not a whole lot of things I remember specifically about that day, other than said my kids acting a little unruly in front of the president and the first lady. The thing I do really remember vividly, though, is I remembered I being up on stage and feeling just embarrassed and not. I just felt like I wanted to disappear. It was just weird to sit up there and hear all these things being talked about and all these heroics and this and that. And in the back of my mind, like I said, I just wanted to disappear. So I was sitting there and I was thinking of Kirk and Gallegos and Mace and Hart, and thinking like, those guys aren't here. Why am I getting all this attention? And I'm just trying to pick a spot out on the wall that I can focus on so I just don't totally lose it. And it comes to a moment where I remember looking straight out ahead, and in the first row was my family, my mom and my dad, my brothers, my sisters, and my kids. And right behind them was the eight Gold Star families from the eight men we lost. Their
Oh,
families
boy.
were there.
Yeah.
And then just to the left was my Army family, the guys I served with that day. And I had this moment where it just kind of came over me, and it was like, damn, Clint, this really sucks, but I'm not here alone. I've got all of my family with me. And that's pretty cool.
One of the things that happens over time, I think every Medal of Honor recipient goes through this, where I'm really not worthy, even to the point of saying, I don't want to accept this award, to where the Army says, you have to accept this award, you didn't read the fine print. And the ceremony concludes, and now a decade has passed. You've probably learned a lot about yourself, the country, what it means to be a Medal of Honor recipient. As you look at this decade of having this beautiful burden of being a Medal of Honor recipient, where does that lead you?
It's reflecting on that decade of what I could tell, what I thought the Clint of 2013 knew to the Clint of 2024. Said I, initially, like I said, it was tough to almost overnight be recognized for something like that. And that took me a while to I wouldn't say get used to, but learn how to kind of manage and refocus that. I said, because initially it was embarrassing to sit there and I don't, why am I getting recognized when these guys sacrifice so much more? And that turned into, though, as we, coming up on especially the holidays and just got through Veterans Day, and we'll have Memorial Day coming up here in a few months. And we always say, never forget. We're never going to forget the service, the sacrifice. What I realized is in those 2 years I was working in the oil field, I never talked about Gallegos and Kirk to anybody. And it was like, if I'm not talking about them, I'm not letting people have the ability to never forget. So as time has gone by and dealing with that, that's what I realized. Receiving the medal gives me the opportunity to tell those guys stories that are no longer here to tell it themselves. That's been one of the greater life lessons I've kind of taken after receiving the medal, that the medal might get the attention and I might be the one wearing it, but it gives me the opportunity to shine that light, that spotlight that I don't want showing on me, but I can take that and I can redirect it and talk about the eight men we lost, talk about issues our veterans are having today with the the suicide and underemployment and lack of meaningful employment and issues with their health care and coverage to the VA. It's given me an opportunity and a platform that so many others that have worn the uniform will never get.
As I mentioned at the outset, these Medal of Honor recipients are really good guys, humble guys. You know, they all don't want this recognition, but they learn how to use it. This ran a little long. Let's hear from our sponsors, and we'll get you one more Medal of Honor story before we get out of here.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. Even small actions can make a world of difference. If you know a veteran in crisis, please call the Veterans Crisis Line, 800-273-8255. 800-273-8255. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
Well, I don't really have enough time to do the Medal of Honor recipient Earl Plumlee's story, Proper Justice. So what I'm going to do is drop in a short interview that was created regarding a Medal of Honor recipient from Alabama. That's kind of an interesting story as well, Cecil Bolton. So listen to that, and we'll bring you the Plumlee story next month.
Welcome back, everybody, for another deep dive. And today we are going to look at the life of Cecil H. Bolton.
Okay.
This guy led a seriously double life. So our sources today tell a story about a man who was both a really, really great boxer and a total war hero.
Oh, wow.
What made this guy want to be so good at such different things? That's what we are here to figure out today.
Right. Yeah, that is a good question.
Like most of us, we tend to think of boxing as, you know, individual strength.
Right.
And agility and speed. But war often calls for a whole team to work together and strategy and, you know, stuff like that.
Definitely.
So how did both of these experiences come together to form the life of Cecil Bolton?
It's interesting how you wouldn't really think that those two things would go together.
Right.
But maybe they do.
Yeah, maybe. So let's see. Okay, so Cecil H. Bolton was born in Crawfordville, Florida,
right,
way back in 1908.
Wow.
Yeah, and his family, they ended up settling in Huntsville, Alabama sometime in the late 1920s. Now, here's the thing. You ready for this?
Yeah.
Before the war, Bolton was a boxer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and they called him Bushy Bolton.
Bushy Bolton. I love it.
I know, right?
That's great.
And get this, he wasn't messing around.
Oh.
In 1928, he had 37 fights.
What?
37.
Wow.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of fights.
That's a lot of punches.
Yeah.
And he was also a referee, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
He knew the boxing world like inside and out.
It really sounds like he was, you know, at the heart of it all.
Yeah, he was a real local sports star.
Yeah.
His boxing career lasted 16 years.
Wow.
Which is amazing. And he was like a hometown hero in Huntsville.
Yeah, well, it makes you think maybe all those years he spent in the ring, you know, facing different opponents all the time.
Yeah.
Maybe that's where he got his mental toughness from.
Right.
You know, like maybe that's where he learned to be so resilient.
Yeah, maybe that's how he was able to do all the crazy stuff he did on the battlefield later on.
Right, like a different type of training, you know.
Yeah, it's not something you'd usually connect boxing and, you know, being a war hero.
Right.
But you're right, maybe all those years boxing really did get him ready to be courageous.
And, you know, Bolton was also a really smart businessman.
Oh, yeah.
He owned a nightclub even.
Yeah.
And he managed some other boxers. He was a big part of the Huntsville community.
So not just a tough guy, but a real leader too.
Exactly. And I bet all that experience helped him become a great leader in the Army later on.
Yeah, you're right. Because leading a bunch of boxers and running a business, you have to inspire people and come up with plans and make tough decisions.
For sure.
And those are all things that are important in war too.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got Bushy Bolton, the hometown boxing hero,
right,
a successful businessman, and a leader in Huntsville.
Yep.
Then 1942 comes along, and everything changes.
World War II.
Yep, and at 33 years old, Bolton gets drafted into the Army.
Wow. Can you imagine going from boxing rings and nightclubs to, like, boot camp?
That is a huge change.
Yeah. And what do you think? How do you think he dealt with that?
It must have been really hard.
Total.
But I bet even though everything was different,
yeah,
some things probably stayed the same.
Like what?
Well, in boxing and war, there's one main goal.
To win.
To win, that's it.
Okay.
And to do that, you need discipline and focus.
Yeah.
And you have to push yourself beyond your limits.
Totally.
And those are all things Bolton learned from boxing.
Yeah. So maybe those years in the ring gave him like a mental model for dealing with challenges.
Yeah, even if they're completely different challenges.
Exactly.
Like war instead of boxing.
And don't forget about his leadership skills.
Oh, right.
From managing those boxers and running that nightclub.
Yeah.
I bet that helped him adjust to leading soldiers.
Yeah, because in the army, it's not just about you anymore.
Yep.
You're part of a team and you're responsible for other people.
Exactly. So Bolton goes through basic training, then he does really well at officer candidate school, and he becomes a second lieutenant.
Okay.
And then they assign him as a weapons platoon leader in Company E, 2nd Battalion, 413th Infantry Regiment, 104th Infantry Division.
Wow, that's a lot.
It is, isn't it?
So for someone like me who doesn't know anything about the military, what does all that even mean?
So basically, a weapons platoon is like a special unit within a bigger company.
Okay.
And they're the ones with the big guns.
Okay.
Like machine guns and mortars.
Oh, wow.
So in Bolton's case, that meant he was right there on the front lines leading his men into battle.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the 104th Infantry Division. Get this. They had a nickname.
What was it?
The Timberwolves.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I know, right? Those nicknames are kind of like taking that team spirit from boxing and bringing it to the battlefield.
Right.
It's all about having that feeling of being a part of something bigger.
So Bolton, our boxer, is now Lieutenant Bolton leading a weapons platoon called the Timberwolves.
Yep.
What happens next?
Well, August 27th, 1944, the Timberwolves sail off to Europe.
Cool.
They arrive in France on September 7th.
Okay.
And by October 23rd, they're fighting in Voustvezel, Belgium.
So things move pretty quickly.
Very quickly.
And I bet the closer they got to the fighting, the more intense things got.
I'm sure it was pretty stressful.
Yeah. So that brings us to a really important part of Bolton's story.
Yes, it does.
November 2, 1944.
Okay.
The Timberwolves had just crossed the Mark River in the Netherlands.
Uh-huh.
And as soon as they do, they get hit with all this enemy fire.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was bad.
Oh, no, it was really bad.
So they're like trapped and getting shot at from all sides.
Yeah, it was a tough spot. Two German machine guns had them totally pinned down.
Oh, wow.
And their mortars weren't doing any good because they couldn't see where the Germans were.
Okay.
So people were getting hurt.
Man, I can't even imagine what that must have been like.
It's hard to picture, isn't it? All that chaos and the fear and the noise.
Yeah, definitely.
And to make things even worse, Bolton was already hurt.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, he had shrapnel in both legs, a bullet in his shoulder.
Oh, my God.
Another one that just grazed his mouth. And he'd even been knocked unconscious for a bit.
Seriously? You think that would be enough to make anyone give up?
Yeah, you'd think. Right. But not Bolton. Remember we were talking about how tough he was from all that boxing?
Right. Yeah.
What really came in handy here, even though he was all messed up, his first thought was for his men.
So like a true leader.
Yeah. He knew they were stuck and needed to get out of there.
So what'd he do?
He crawled over to his guys and asked for volunteers. And get this, he waded into this freezing cold water that was up to his chest to try to take out those machine guns himself.
Wow, he was already hurt and he's going to go put himself in even more danger.
It's pretty amazing when you think about it. He wasn't worried about himself at all.
Wow.
All he cared about was getting his men to safety.
That's incredible.
It really is a crazy level of selflessness.
Okay, so how did he take out the machine guns?
We got to the first one using grenades.
Okay.
Took it out. And then went back to his bazooka team to get the second one.
So he's dodging bullets and freezing in this water, and he's still going.
Oh, yeah. And he wasn't done yet.
There's more.
After they took care of the machine guns, Bolton realized there was this big 88-millimeter artillery gun that was just hammering the American lines.
Okay.
So he leads his bazooka team over to that thing, braving all the enemy fire and that ice-cold water again.
Man, this guy is unstoppable.
I know, right? He had such courage, and he was so strategic about it all, picking out the biggest threats and taking them out one by one.
Uh-huh.
And thanks to him and his bazooka team, they destroyed that artillery gun, which gave them a much better chance of surviving.
So he basically took out three major enemy positions all by himself.
Pretty much, yeah. And remember, he was doing all this while he was seriously wounded.
Right.
He actually got hit again during all this.
Yeah.
But he refused to get any help.
Why?
All he cared about was his men. He wanted to make sure they got out of there safely.
Man, that's just crazy.
And as he told his guys to retreat while he covered them.
Wow.
He crawled back to their lines until he finally collapsed.
I can't even imagine what that must have done to him, both physically and mentally.
I know it's hard to fathom. By November 7th, the Timberwolves had accomplished their mission.
Good.
But it came at a huge cost.
How huge?
They lost almost 1,500 men, 313 killed in action, and 103 missing.
Oh my God.
I know it's a lot. Major General Terry De La Mesa Allen Sr., their commander, sent each one of his men a letter.
Oh, wow.
Congratulating them. And at the end of each letter, he wrote his motto, "Nothing in hell must stop the Timberwolves."
Oh, man, that gives me chills.
It's pretty powerful, isn't it?
Yeah.
It really shows how tough and determined the 104th Infantry Division was. And it shows just how much they sacrificed.
And what Bolton did that day perfectly represents that spirit.
Absolutely.
He was given a Silver Star for his actions, which was later upgraded to the Medal of Honor.
Yeah. On September 4th, 1945, President Truman himself gave him the medal in this big ceremony at the White House.
Wow.
He was one of 28 heroes who got medals that day, including another guy from Alabama named Paul L. Bolden.
That must have been an incredible moment for him.
It must have been to receive that recognition after everything he'd been through. And he got other medals, too.
Yeah.
You know?
What else did he get?
2 Bronze Stars and 2 Purple Hearts.
Wow. So what did the Medal of Honor citation actually say about what he did that day?
Well, it's a pretty powerful document that really captures his bravery and selflessness. I think it's worth reading a part of it here.
Okay, let's hear it.
Okay, it says, "As leader of the weapons platoon of Company E, 413th Infantry Regiment, 104th Infantry Division, on the night of 2 November 1944, First Lieutenant Bolton fought gallantly in a pitched battle which followed the crossing of the Mark River in Holland."
So it starts by setting the scene, you know, the craziness of the battle and how hard it was to fight there.
Exactly. And then it talks about how Bolton first tried to use the mortars to take out the machine guns, but they couldn't see where they were.
Okay.
And he kept directing the fire until he got hurt so badly that he was knocked out.
That's some serious determination.
It really is. He didn't give up even after being wounded. And then the citation goes on to describe how he took out the machine guns and that 88-millimeter artillery piece.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about how brave he was and how he was a great leader and how he was thinking strategically the whole time.
It really paints a picture of what a hero he was, doesn't it?
It does. And it finishes by saying how he wouldn't let anyone help him. And he made sure his men retreated while he crawled back.
It's such an amazing story.
It really is a story about sacrificing yourself for the people you care about.
So what happened to Bolton after the war? How do you go back to normal life after going through something like that?
I know. It's hard to imagine going back to, like, everyday life.
Yeah.
But Bolton, he stayed in the Army.
Oh, really?
Yeah, even through the Korean War.
Wow.
He really dedicated his life to serving his country. And he ended up becoming a colonel before he retired.
So from boxer to war hero to colonel.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
It is. It shows how he could adapt to anything and how committed he was.
Yeah, he wasn't just one thing. But his story, it doesn't have a happy ending, does it?
No. Sadly, Cecil Bolton died pretty young, actually.
Oh.
Yeah, he was only 56.
Wow.
He passed away at Brooke Army Hospital in Fort Sam Houston, Texas, January 22, 1965.
Man, that's a reminder that even the toughest guys...
Yeah.
They're still human.
They are.
So what happened after he died?
Well, he was buried with full military honors.
Okay.
At the Fort Sam Houston National Cemetery in San Antonio, Texas.
Okay.
And his wife, Bessie, she was buried there with him when she passed away in 1978.
That's nice that they're together.
Yeah.
It's a fitting tribute to a man who spent his life helping others.
Yeah, and his legacy, it lives on.
How so?
While in Panacea, Florida, where he was born.
Uh-huh.
They built a monument for him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a permanent reminder of his journey from that small town to the battlefields of Europe and back again.
So we've gone from Bushy Bolton, this like charismatic boxer, to Lieutenant Bolton, the war hero, to Colonel Bolton, who served his country his whole life.
It's quite a story, isn't it? Full of twists and turns.
Yeah, it really is. And I think what makes it so interesting is that it challenges the way we think.
How so?
Well, we don't usually think of a boxer becoming a war hero, but Bolton's life shows us that those two things can actually work together.
Yeah.
It's a reminder that people are complicated.
Yeah.
They have hidden depths and they can always surprise us.
Exactly.
And I think there's something we can all learn from this.
What's that?
Bolton's story teaches us to look deeper than the surface to see that courage and leadership can pop up in unexpected places.
Yeah, I like that.
His life shows us the power of never giving up
and
putting others first.
And how strong the human spirit can be.
Yeah, it's a really inspiring story. I think we've done a good job of exploring the life of Cecil H. Bolton.
I think so, too.
From boxing to war, his story is all about bravery, determination, and always being there for the people around him.
It reminds us that heroes are everywhere, even in places we might not expect. So keep your eyes open and never stop looking for those incredible stories of bravery and resilience.
And on that note, I think we'll wrap up our deep dive into the amazing life of Cecil H. Bolton.
Sounds good.
Thanks for joining us, everyone.
We couldn't really do this work without the help of our sponsors. They include the National Vietnam Veterans Association of America, VVA chapter, Charles S. Kettles chapter in Ann Arbor, the VFW chapter in Ann Arbor, the American Legion chapter in Ann Arbor, our friends at nvbdc.org, at Pure Clean, and at Legal Help for Veterans. So, didn't get to everything we wanted to do this time. It goes real fast. We'll be back next week with more stories, and I'll be back next month with a Medal of Honor story. Follow Veterans Radio on Facebook. Listen to our podcast, which we post new ones every week. And until next time on Veterans Radio, when Dale's back with stories, and I'll be back next month again, as I said, with more Medal of Honor stories. But until next time, you are dismissed.